Who will win the vote? Does it matter for the economy and the markets?
This is Jerry Tumas Smart Money, a broadcast of Cornerstone Financial Services with Cornerstone President and Founder, Jerry Tuma. Jerry Tuma is a certified financial planner. Securities and advisory services offered through Independent Financial Group, LLC, a registered investment advisor, member, FINRA, and SIPC. Cornerstone Financial Services and Independent Financial Group, LLC, are unaffiliated entities. Views and opinions heard on Jerry Tuma Smart Money are not necessarily the opinion of this station, or its management, or Independent Financial Group, LLC, its affiliates, officers, or directors. Material on this program is intended for general information only and should not be taken as specific investment, tax, or legal advice. We are here to talk about your finances, investments, and the economy, and we are aiming to change the way America thinks about investing.
Welcome to Smart Money with Jerry Tuma. This is Michael Williams. Well, Jerry, we do have a jobs number that came out this morning as we record on Friday. But first, you know, we've kind of got something that's kind of a hot topic across the country right now.
Kinda.
Maybe some voting going on. You know, we've talked about this off and on. A lot of our research that we read from is, of course, it's been a hot topic throughout the year. Everybody wants to analyze every little detail of how this election could possibly affect a market, how it could affect the economy. Some of them get way too detailed and specific. Like, well, if you look at your chart, it's actually not telling you anything.
Yeah.
But what does it actually mean for the economy and the markets?
And Michael, I'm glad you pointed that out, because for the last several months, I've just kind of been pushing that stuff to the side, going, wait till we get closer to the election. Wait till you get to the point where it makes sense to even look at it. Let's talk about the election for a moment, because I know it's going to be a hot topic coming up next week. And my wife and I have already voted. I hope you have, too. Makes it more unlikely that cheating can occur, I guess, if you vote early. I don't know. Maybe not. But we're not in a swing state anyway, so I don't think it makes much difference in Texas, probably. Hopefully not. The election I'm just putting in is too close to call. I wrote in parenthesis, as usual.
And I would say this morning, our BCA geopolitical analyst, Matt Gerken, was on again. I didn't get to catch the whole thing. I had a little technical issue, but I did catch he and the two people he was interviewing are people he's worked with for many, many years on elections and stuff. And they were basically saying the same thing. They still think Trump is favored, but it's too close to call.
It is. And so my base case, what I'm going to base today's show on, is in a way kind of going out on a limb, because I'm going to base my case on Trump winning. And probably winning the Senate. Now, most people think that if Trump wins, he's going to lose the House. So I just, you know, if there's a red sweep, that'll change things significantly. Personally, I think it's going to end up likely being a disputed election, and it probably will not be called on the night of the election. I mean, there's too many swing states, and there's too much shenanigans can go on in those very swing states.
I think people should prep for the fact we're not going to know on Tuesday who won.
We might not know for a week, or, man, hanging chad election is a month. Yeah. But the bottom line is I'm operating under the base case. Now, on the one hand, this kind of violates one of the principles that we tell everybody, don't presume the future, like it talks about in James chapter 4. But at the same time, I'm like, and maybe it's just me politically, maybe it's just me emotionally, but I just cannot envision Kamala and Waltz in the White House. It's just like, this does not look right. Like it's, and it's not just my wishes, it's just I don't think it's going to happen. I may have egg on my face this time next week and decide, oh no, somehow, now what are we going to do? Well, we'll have to change strategies, but that gives you just a little, plenty of time. The one thing that people underestimate is the fact that it takes a very long time. It's another reason I have not been paying a whole lot of attention or talking about this on the show very much for months of this whole year. And that's because it takes so long to get anything done anyway. I mean, an executive action can be done instantaneously, you know, like Biden did, you know, signed all those bills and Kamala put one in front of him. What is this one? Doesn't matter. Just sign it, you know, kind of thing. I don't know if you remember, saw that video. But bottom line is they can do certain things as executives on day one. But anything really meaningful pertaining to the economy is going to have to go through Congress and the Senate. And so you really have to go, yes, Border Patrol. I mean, there are a lot of things that the president can implement immediately. But again, that's not until, January. So the bottom line is going to be very interesting to see. And as a matter of fact, I'm concerned that if Trump does win, then who knows what kind of rioting is going to break out between now and January 5th or 6th, whatever date they take office. We'll see. We'll see. Anyway, so the base case is starting on Trump winning and the Senate, probably, maybe not the House. Right now, and I'm just looking at the latest from Matt Gerken. He's our top political analyst with Bank Credit Analyst. The key states, as of now, and I mean now meaning like this moment, it's actually 11:30 on Friday that we're recording this show. As of this moment, Trump is favored in all of the swing states except Michigan. But one of the interesting things that I saw in Matt's report was Michigan is now entering a recession. Michigan has now entered in a recession, and it's fully in a recession. Nevada is right behind them. The interesting thing will be, will that turn the tide toward Trump in Michigan? We will see. We will see. So anyhow, the economy is doing poorly in a lot of different sectors of the economy, in Michigan in particular. Note, though, that one of the things that's really happening, and I'm not really sure, this kind of jumped out at me in a recent report I was reading. I don't remember now if it was from Bank Credit Analyst or Alpine Macro, whomever it was from. But it just jumped out at me. You know, in my day, when I was growing up, you were either Republican or Democrat. Independents were small, I mean, very small minority. You think back to those of you old enough to remember the Kennedy-Nixon election. You know, I mean, there was a very small minority of people that weren't one side or the other.
And I would also say that being Republican or Democrat, it wasn't, you weren't that far off from each other. It was much more centralized.
Yeah, yeah.
And, we weren't at the extremes.
My dad always taught me, vote for the man, not the party.
Right.
Which in those days, I think, made a difference. Because you could have somebody who was Republican or who was Democrat, who was conservative back in those days. Of course, that's long gone. That's in the dustbins of history at this point.
And back then, you could talk to your neighbor, even if they were voting for someone different, and it wasn't a fight.
I know. It wasn't. Yeah, I'm not mad at you over this whole thing. Yeah, my people across the street from us that were good friends we played cards with, or my parents played cards with on the weekends. They were voting for Kennedy, and my parents voted for, you know, for Nixon. Anyway, so the bottom line is it was a lot different back then. Nowadays, according to the most recent information, and I believe this was from Alpine Macro, but don't quote me on that, independents now make up, people that are voting independent that are not either Republican or Democrat now make up 70% of the populace. I mean, good grief. What that means is the uncertainty has never been this high in American history. I think that all points back to things we'll talk about not on today's show, about the fourth turning kind of events we've talked about over the time. But if 70% independent, and that this thing can swing wildly, and that's one reason the elections have been so hard to call, really since, you know, really since between Bush and Gore. So right now, the market is kind of betting on the economy improving under Trump. And they did a poll in all sections of the economy, all voters. They sliced and diced the voters into various states. Besides the states, they also sliced and diced the voters into likely voters, independents, age 45 and above, suburban, no college degree, women, race black, race Hispanic. And if in each case, as Bank Credit Analyst did this poll or reported on the poll, the economy is doing poorly was unanimous across the board. All sections of voters said the economy is doing poorly. When you tally them, said, okay, now, do you think the economy will do better for Trump? And by the way, it's interesting, a good friend of mine who's been a political pundit in Washington for years basically said he was in the Reagan administration. He said what happens is, and now this number has changed a little bit, he said about a third of the people are socialist, and they're going to vote left. About a third of the people are conservatives, they're going to vote right. Now that number, I think, is shrinking. But he said the third in the middle puts their finger in the air, says, which way is the economy blowing, and they vote that direction.
Right. How's it hitting my pocketbook?
I still think that is true, except the number in the middle is now bigger. Anyway, so if you look at who's better for the economy, Trump won hands down on every category except for blacks. 72% voted for Harris. Anyway, the likely voters, 49% said Trump was better. Independents, That's important because now we're talking about 70% of the populace. Independents, 49% of them said Trump would be better for the economy. Only 38% said Harris. So if you look through the suburban, the college degrees, et cetera, pretty well everybody is betting on the fact that they think the economy will be better under Trump. And I think that that's a good vote. However, I also think that there's going to be some surprises with that. And I was ardently, adamantly, passionately in favor of Trump's first term. I remember when I did the show, this was in 2016, I guess, 2015, late 2015. Daryl Delphin, who works for us, basically was laughing. He said, "That was an amazing show. It was highly passionate. You were agitated." He said, "And you didn't even look at one single note. I could tell from the start to the finish of the show, you were just adamant. You were just blowing out of everything you already knew." It was a fun show. I remember that. But to me, I'm seeing a little bit of difference this time. And so Trump, on the one hand, is clearly, I probably shouldn't tell people that maybe who I voted for. But the bottom line is, there's a couple of things that I think are different this time, and that's why I'm not as enthused about it in terms of the economy and the market. So I think, first of all, I think if Trump does win, especially if he wins at least one chamber of the legislative branch, then I think there'll be a burst of enthusiasm very likely. So the bear market we've been anticipating, if you look back at history, and I cannot remember exactly, I think it was McClellan studied this. He said the history is, frequently, you'll have a peak in the economy or the stock market on the day of the election, and then a back off, and then another peak around the inauguration. And that might be the end of the whole thing. And I think that makes a lot of sense. So I think you'll see initially a burst of great enthusiasm over this whole thing. Then after a moment or two, people stop and go, "Oh, well, okay, now that our enthusiasm and excitement's died down, what does that really mean?" And they start to analyze the details. Now, one of the things that is likely, because again, Trump cannot institute things unless it's an executive order. Tariffs are immediate executive order. He can start on tariffs on day one. The way he's been approaching this running for president again, I'll be surprised if he doesn't pass tariffs on day one. Now, we also know from his background, he's a negotiator. So he'll start high and then he'll bid it down. But that's going to have an immediate impact that's negative on the world economy. Think about it for a moment. If he passes a big pill, even if it's only against China, that's going to have an immediate impact. I was looking at a chart earlier today about the previous time that he passed the tariffs. And he didn't pass them right away. He waited well into his regime, and then he passed the tariffs and the Purchasing Managers Index and so forth. The international measures, if you will, plummeted about 30% over about a six-month period while he was fighting with China over the tariffs. Now, the U.S. economy was in a very nice recovery. I think he did great on cutting the corporate tax rates. He's talking about cutting them again. I still don't think that's a negative. I think that's a positive. But if you look at the sequence of this, that's what's important to me, the sequence of this, the tariffs will have an immediate impact to the economy. And we're seeing, we're going to go into detail, great detail on today's show about we've been talking about for months, the leading index of economic indicators is still falling. The intermediate type of indicators are now falling. We'll talk about that in detail. It's kind of like we've always used the analogy of the train. The leading economic indicators are the engine. Think of the bright red engine on the front. The engine is leading the train. The rest of the train is falling behind. The unemployment rate is always the caboose. So you have certain things that people watch in the media, and I'm like, didn't you take macroeconomics 101?
No.
No.
Or they don't remember it.
They didn't take it. I've had that response a number of times. I've interviewed people that do a lot of media interviews because they got a new book out. They're like, your questions are very detailed. A lot of them say, you ask extremely tough questions, but I like the interview because it's tough questions. They said the media has their depth is about a quarter of an inch thick. And if you go past one little quarter inch, they don't have a clue what they're even talking about, nor do they have in-depth questions typically. Now, there's exceptions to that one. But I think the burst of enthusiasm is very likely, number one. Number two, I think it's the day he gets in office, he's likely going to pass some tariffs. Now, again, we know he's a negotiator, so some of those tariffs might change and probably will change. But right now, I really think he's not going to be looking for re-election this time. He can't go into re-election. I think he's likely to be a lot more determined and a lot more adamant than he's ever been, hardened on his position. And honestly, I think that the Democrats or whoever shot him in the ear made that worse. I think that made him even more determined to be what he's going to be in his plans. And I don't agree with necessarily all of his viewpoints on life. So anyway, I do think that small businesses may shout hooray, because they feel overtaxed right now. They feel overregulated, and I think that might be a big plus, and it could affect the economy, and it could affect the market right away. But some of the other consequences, I think the tariffs are going to be negative unless you're in an industry that is being negatively impacted by foreign trade. Now, if you're an industry that is being negatively impacted by foreign trade, then you're going to put the party balloons up and get out the party hats. It will not be stimulative to the U.S. economy or the market. Now, it will be stimulative to sections of the U.S. economy, but the overall picture for the global economy is not going to be a positive. It's going to be a negative, and the question is, how negative is it going to be? Now, they pose the question with the bank credit analysts. They said, okay, how quickly will he be able to pass other bills that would be stimulus for the economy? And the answer is, we're not sure about that. Right now, when you look at the ISM Manufacturing Index, the Purchasing Manager Index, back in 2020, when he passed the last bill, I believe it was 2020. I got the chart right in front of me somewhere in all my piles of stuff. It essentially shows that there was about a 30% decline in the Purchasing Manager Index when he passed his tariffs the first time. Yeah, this is from bank credit analysts. The second Trump presidency could easily push bond yields lower, not necessarily higher. But anyway, there's a huge drop in the World Uncertainty Index and the U.S. ISM Manufacturing Index. So I'm not trying to be negative about Trump getting into office. I'm trying to give you the realistic viewpoint of, hey, if that happens, don't just go down and I'm going to put a gazillion more dollars in the market necessarily. I'm not saying you can't. I'm not saying you shouldn't. I'm saying be careful here, because I still think we're in a topping out process, and we'll come back to that in a moment. A topping process, historically speaking, it's very rare for the stock market to have any sort of a dunce cap type peak. It normally is a process, a rolling process. It can be flat, or it can be rolling upward with an upward tilt, slightly upward tilt, which is what I think we're going through right now. NASDAQ has not really, it marginally had a new high, but it doesn't look like it's going to blow out to a new high. If I look at the things that have been driving NASDAQ, which is the Facebook, Amazon, Netflix, Google, etc., I don't see them just shooting like fireworks through the air into new heights. They're already grossly overvalued. We'll talk about that in a moment. So I think that the global trade is going to slow down. It could end up being a shock if you pass I'm not saying this is necessarily going to happen. I'm saying here's what if. If he comes in and starts banging the gavel, if you will, on tariffs, and you don't have an offsetting stimulus coming in at the same time, that's going to be a net negative for the economy. Over and out. And so what he's going to have to do is try to see if Congress is willing to go along with him. Number one, does he have all red? Does he have a split, one house blue and one house red? Or what's he going to do? And I think that the key will be, what happens next. I'm concerned that may be how he starts the Trump administration. And I'm concerned that that's a significant risk to the U.S. and world economy. And I still think that probably the biggest risk, though, is geopolitical. I still think that the likelihood is extremely high that Netanyahu promised Biden he would not go on a really high-end offensive. I mean, they did send missiles, but to me, those missiles were, it was kind of like, okay, are we really serious? Yeah, they took out some key targets. But it was not an all-out blitz. It was not, okay, we're going to blast you off the earth. we're tired of messing with you and all your proxies. We're going to take you out so that you stop bugging us. That's not what they did. So what's happening here, I think, is we're pre-election. I still think the market is in a, quote, topping out process. I reserve the right to change my opinion later. I think we'll know after January. I don't really think we're going to know until January because the election is going to impact a lot of what's going on here. So I think with the election still too close to call, it's too early to tell. I think on the stock market, valuations are still very high. And if you look at the history of this, we talked about this last week. Goldman Sachs came out with a study based on where they thought the valuations were. Now, keep in mind, what are valuations? Valuations are a benchmark, if you will. Think of a high jump. I don't know. For some reason, I was on Facebook last night, and it was showing Wilt Chamberlain in his prime, in his college days. And he could do a high jump. Back then, they didn't do the Fosbury flop where they went over backward. They would just run over with their – take their right leg and go over and try to curl over the thing. But he was high jumping like 6 foot five and long jumping, and he was doing the triple jump. And I think at his peak, he could bench press like 450 pounds. He's quite the extraordinary athlete. Oh, and he ran the 400-meter dash, too. Anyway, so he was quite an athlete. But anyway – it showed Wilt Chamberlain jumping over that high bar. I still think you got to understand how high is the market relative to history. That doesn't mean it can't go higher. It means this, how much risk are you taking? Again, Goldman Sachs said, based on where we see the market today, we think you're going to have about a 3% rate of return between now and 10 years from now. That is not including a fourth tourney kind of event, which is not what this show's about. But it's something I want to keep repeating because we will be talking about it probably a lot before the end of the year. Fourth tourney is once every 80 to 100 years. You go through a cycle of history, and it can be devastating. And you can see that lining up potentially with China, with Russia, with North Korea, and with Iran. So anyway, so stocks are still high on the Case-Shiller Index, and they're actually moving slightly higher. The Case-Shiller Index, it's only the third highest market in the history of the planet. Only number three. That's not very high. The price-to-book ratio we mentioned before for the market, and again, the caveat to valuations are not good timing indicators. They're risk indicators. They're terrible at timing. They could be off by, you know, so you don't want to go, oh, well, the market's peaking on the price-earnings ratio. I can get out of the market. Now, what if you're a year early? I mean, you can be way early if you're only looking at valuations. You got to look at other things for the timing, which we'll come back to in a moment. But the price-to-book value ratio, it still remains at the highest level in U.S. history. So it's Mount Kilimanjaro. And the price-to-sales ratio, we were at K2. Now we've passed. We are tied with Mount Everest based on the chart, maybe slightly ahead of Mount Everest. So if you look at valuations, the issue, the old analogy everybody uses is you have snow on the Alps, too much snow on the side of the Alps. You can tell it's unstable. You can tell there's too much snow built up. When is somebody going to fire the cannon? We don't know. What's a cannon going to be? Is it going to be a trade war started by Trump? I don't know. Is it going to be a physical war started by Israel? I don't know. Is it going to be some unforeseen thing inside the economy that nobody is aware of right now? I don't know. I do know this, though, that when the market gets to extraordinary historic tops, meaning extraordinary historic valuations, I should have said, extraordinary times when the market is extremely overvalued, those are normally not good entry points to the market. That's why Goldman Sachs came out last week and said, by the way, we think that you're going to make probably 3% return 10 years out. Oh, and by the way, in the middle of all that, you may have another devastating crash, bear market, possibly as bad as 2008 or 2000. So I think that you've got to be aware, and we talked about this last week, from a behavioral science standpoint, when stocks are high, everybody's ebullient emotionally. When stocks are high, everybody, the perception in our emotion is that risk is low. Why? Because we work off of recency. Recency, our history tells us the market's been going up and up and up and up and up, and everything's great, and we're having such fun, and we're ebullient, and our emotions are just juiced up. And they're the worst possible indicator, because what happens is when you get to that top, whenever the top is, it turns. So when the market is high, risk is actually high. But it feels low emotionally. When the market is low, think of March of 2000. Think of March of 2009. March of 2009, it felt like the whole world was falling apart. Risk was actually very low at that point. It just didn't look like it because it had crashed and the media was full of bad reports. And the media, especially if, I hate to say this, Republicans in the White House, they will talk about bad news on the economy for months or even years. I still remember, this won't cost you any extra, when Bush came out in the Bush administration, they had a period of time where corporate earnings experienced double-digit numbers on growth for 16 consecutive calendar quarters that had never occurred in market history, and yet the economy had most people believing we were almost in a depression. That didn't cost you any extra. More with Smart Money with Michael Williams, Jerry Tuma, coming right back.
All right, so we'd like to take a small break here to remind you how you can learn more about us, cornerstonereport.com. cornerstonereport.com. You can, again, find out more information about us. You can read Jerry's latest special report, Election Blues. And you can also go and find previous radio shows if you missed a week or want to recommend somebody go catch up on something we said recently. Again, just cornerstonereport.com. If you'd like to reach out for a free consultation, please give us a call at 800-327-4285. That's 800-327-4285. Well, Jerry, before we took a little pause there, we were talking about the valuations in the market. And if you're not quite sure what we mean by that, one common TV show that people seem to watch a lot, has been on for a while, is Shark Tank. And that's what they do. When people come and pitch their company and say, hey, I want you to invest in us, they're telling them, they're always asking them, what are your sales? What's your revenue? What's your profit? Because there's different ways to evaluate what is a company worth.
Yeah.
And so they're trying to decide, what are you worth to me? If I invest X number of dollars, how am I going to get it back?
Because if you overpay for it, you're going to lose your money.
Yeah, or it'll take you forever to get it back.
Right. And if you get a great deal, which probably you're not on Shark Tank. But anyway, and that's kind of the way the market is. So the valuations are very important. That's a good analogy. How much are you paying for the stock that you're buying? It's not just a market. It's a market of stocks. To have a continuing bull from here, which means I will turn out to be wrong if that happens, and I'll be the first to admit it, but probably not till February, till we see what happens with the election. Number one, we have to have a soft landing, which I think is very unlikely, and we'll talk about why in just a moment. Number two, disinflation or slower inflation must remain in place or go lower. And earnings growth from the economy must remain strong. So all those things that are assumptions of the continuing bull market. And by the way, remember, folks, I'm not always right, but normally speaking, the market is wrong at the major turning points. That's why they're called major turning points. When you get to the top, everybody's ebullient and bullish. And when you get to the bottom, everybody's gloomy and doomy. And I just don't see that this is going to be any different than the past cycles.
Well, this week, even just yesterday, I was sitting in David McCord's office, our chartered market technician, and I was asking him about the earnings reports that are going on.
Mm-hmm.
And he was getting very detailed to me about different companies and stuff, but the overall picture, it was very mixed.
Very mixed.
Very mixed.
And so that means that a lot of them are not having great reports. Some are still having great reports, but that's kind of the slow progression. When you start into a downturn in the economy and or market, certain sectors of the economy are going to start suffering first, and their earnings reports are going to be the weakest.
Mm-hmm.
So unless this is just a temporary, where, okay, we're going into a true soft landing, we're going to come down and almost crash on the runway, but you're right before you get into the trees, they manage to pull it up, and that's what the Fed's job is to do. But it's never happened before with this much economic tight money supply, which is what we put in our newsletter, by the way, which is now free on our website, called Election Blues. And it's now looking like I'm early on this. Historically speaking, full disclosure here, I'm usually early, but most of the time on the major turning points, I'm right, and we'll have to talk about that a different time. One positive about the market right now, margin debt, which is built-in selling if you start into a bear, it's the second highest in history, but the good news is it's not as bad as 2021. So again, it's not Mount Everest, it's K2. The external shock to me is still the biggest issue. When the Fed has been tightening up, something usually breaks. Some plumbing somewhere in the economy usually breaks. I think you have the outside external risks with Trump and the tariffs, I think, is a potential negative unless he gets an offsetting amount of fiscal stimulus coming in to offset the negative impact that's going to have on the world. And I still think that the Middle East could be our primary candidate. So,
and I think, you know, that overvaluation we're talking about, that puts the market at more risk of this outside shock.
Oh, very much so.
And so if a shock comes in when you're not overvalued, you're more robust, you can handle it better.
Exactly. The market could be, we had a really bad recession, for example, when I was in this industry, I got in 1980. In 1982 was a terrible recession. I could make the case that, you know, it was different in that 2008 was life-threatening to the whole world economy because the biggest investment banks in the world were going under, and those that didn't go under had to be bailed out. All right, but if you look at the actual economic numbers, the 1980-82 bear market, you had inflation running 13%, higher than this most recent time, and the unemployment rate was 12.5%, which is nowhere near. What did we get up to 9 temporarily here in the COVID spike, and then it went down quickly, 12.5%. And it just the economy was just in complete doldrums because of how bad that was. But the bear market that went with that was only down about 25%. Why is that? Because stocks were super cheap at that time. One of our investment all-stars, John Templeton, made the point. He said, stocks are in America are so supremely undervalued. This is the buy of a lifetime. That's what he said in 1982. This is like a kid going into an ice cream shop and getting a full free deck. You can eat as much ice cream as you want, as often as you want. Just go to town eating ice cream until you pass out. He said, this is such an incredible buy for the U.S. back in 1982, and he was exactly right. So anyway, and by the way, we do want to point out a couple of other things in the show before we run out of time. I'm going to talk a little bit about the economy, not a lot, because there's not a lot new going on there. But there are some new things happening in the leading indexes that are changing things, because the caboose is not going to show up until the very end on the economy train. The leading indicators have been leading for a long time negative. The middle of the train is starting to go the wrong direction now. We'll come back to that in a moment.
Well, and you kind of skipped over. You said not much happened in the economy, but we had a big number come out today.
Oh, we did. That's true. We did. Yes, we had only 12,000 jobs added in October. Now, the speculation, the market went up as a result of that.
They're expecting 100,000 jobs. We had 12,000.
Had something to do with the hurricane, probably. How much, we don't know.
I can't imagine the hurricane is responsible for a near 90% drop.
Probably not. The figures in August and September were revised lower again. I lost 46,000 manufacturing jobs. You're not going to really know how they're going to revise these numbers until, you know, 2 or 3 months later. Remember, for the economy, here's what you want to know. There's three sources of income, because consumption is what drives the economy. At the end of the day, personal consumption is 70% of the GDP. 10% of it is business spending. Businesses will not spend if the consumer is not spending. As a matter of fact, the consumer spending slows down at a slower rate because people still have to buy food and go to work and do the jobs and get gasoline and all that. But when businesses see a cutback in spending, they cut radically. I mean, they can cut radically, and it's only a 10% margin of the economy. But when they, I'll go through and get the details for this for the next week's show. But when they cut back a lot, and then people start losing jobs. And that's the whole thing about this. If you're dealing with consumption, there's three sources of money. Number one is pass income. That's one reason this stimulus package, this time that we've been in, has been a slower, in my view, a slower period of time for the normal forces of energy to take place, because there was a lot of past income, and some of that wasn't just savings. It was the stimulus bills and the new checks. And you had some people, especially the lower decile or two of income earners in America, that were actually making more on unemployment than they were making at their jobs, because they're at Dairy Queen, you know, or whatever. So the past income appears to be over, although there's not one statistic that measures that real accurately. So they're actually making estimates on that. And it looks like it didn't decline as much as people thought before. But the past income by now is probably gone. That was in 2020. Present income, money that you make from earning a job. That's one reason jobs are very important. And future, borrowing. If the economy starts going south at all, how many people are going to go, let me get another credit card and I'm going to go out and spend a whole bunch of money and have a big party? Not unless they're forced to. If they're forced to because they're in desperate straits, that's a different story. That is not positive because they're putting themselves in a bigger hole, which will impact their future spending in a big way. So the excess savings doesn't appear to be completely gone, but it's close to gone. And, of course, estimates vary upon that. So the bottom line is the economy, I think, is on sound footing temporarily. But remember, in the last two recessions that we've had, GDP rose about 2.5% in the quarter before the recession started. So historically speaking, there's something, again, as we mentioned before, there's too much snow on the Alps. Something unforeseen, usually an outside shock of some sort, fires the cannon, and now all of the dominoes start to fall at one time. So right now, if we look at EPB's report, EPB, by the way, has the best information on this of anybody I've seen. And if we come back, if we have time, we're going to talk about something that should be really exciting for you and real important. The difference in cyclical bears in a long-term, what we call secular bull or a secular bear, that's important. We may or may not get time to get into that today. But let's talk about what EPB is. They have some of the best information, maybe the best information on this. So what I'm looking at is, okay, if I want to see where the economy is going to go, first of all, does that have an impact on the market? Absolutely. If the economy goes into recession, the market's going to crash. This depends on how overvalued it is. It depends on how much leverage is in the system. And it depends on how bad the crash is. Those are kind of three things. That's your tornado there. Your tornado is made up of three forces that hit simultaneously. How overvalued is it? How much leverage is it? And how severe are the economic consequences of whatever triggers the event? So with EPB, again, what they're showing, and they've been showing this for a long time, the leading index of economic indicators, the leading part of the economy, is contracting strongly. It has not turned around. It's not sitting well. If a soft landing were going to occur, in my view, the first thing you're going to see is that the leading index of economic indicators is going to turn back up again. It's not only not turning back up, it's still falling at an increasing rate, at a faster rate. So again, imagine this as the engine on the train. If the train is going to change trajectories, so we're going to go from a hard landing to a soft landing here. If the train is going to change trajectories, you're going to have to see the engine turn. And then the rest of everything is going to follow behind it. So here's what I'm seeing right now from the latest thing I just got this week on EPB. They said, first of all, the leading index of economic indicators, the things that precede the economy historically and the rest of the economy follows, are still contracting sharply. Sharply means not straight down, but close. It's contracting sharply. The cyclical economy, that's housing and manufacturing. So that's kind of the middle of the train, if you will. The early part of the middle of the train, it's now contracting. Now, 3 months ago, we first started talking about EPB's material, the cyclical part of the economy, kind of the engine, the middle of the train, was not contracting. It was looking toppy, and it was going sideways. Mm-hmm. It had a huge run up. Now it's toppy looking and going sideways. Now it's going straight down. It's contracting. So the leading index of economic indicators is contracting sharply. The cyclical economy is contracting now, what I would call sharply. The aggregate economy, which again, I'll define these things if we have time, the aggregate economy is still growing at 1.5% growth rate. So the back half of the middle of the train is still growing at 1.5%, and the lagging indicators are still holding up at 2.1% growth. So envision the train in four sections. The engine and the leading indicators are going down. Ever been to Six Flags Over Texas and ridden on a roller coaster?
Oh, you bet.
Have you ever been on the front car?
Yes.
If you're on the front car and you're going up this long hill, so you're going tick, 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 clackety 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 clackety. Long hill you go up, these things take forever. Clackety clackety. You get to the top. You're the leading car. It rolls over the top very slowly.
Yes.
It doesn't roll over the top and go straight down fast like it looks like it should be. And you're going, ah, I've got this lost straight down drop coming ahead, but it's going slowly.
And the rest of the passengers are still looking up.
And then all of a sudden you reach an equilibrium point where now all of a sudden half of the cars are over the top of the hill and it starts to accelerate. And then as soon as all of the cars are over the top of the hill, then it shoots straight down the mountain and you're going fast as a bullet. That's what the economy does. Right now, the front car on that roller coaster is going down. The next section of it is actually starting to go down. But what happens is that the back half of the train is still going up. And so it's slowing the front of the descension of the front part of the train yet. But if you look at what causes these things to happen like this, I see zero chance that that's going to stop happening. It's going to roll, in my view, it's going to roll on over, and at some point it's going to start accelerating down. The question is the timing. We don't know the exact timing. We were off. Everybody that was estimating this was off about the excess savings. Okay, the excess savings are going to keep us going for a while. So the four sections of the train, the aggregate economy, which is the current economy, if you want to say, is still growing at a 1.5% rate. It's not in a recession. The lagging economy, which is the very back end of the train, is still growing at 2.1. The leading indicators are contracting sharply. The cyclical economy is contracting sharply, which was not happening 2 months ago. 2 months ago, it was going sideways and starting to roll over. Now it's like the top of that roller coaster, it is starting to roll down, and it is going down sharply. It's not going down just a little bit.
Yeah, 2 months ago, it was like at the peak. Now, it's with the leading cars, and it's pointing downwards.
Exactly, and that's what's happening in the economy today. So, I refuse to change my mind until the indicators change. So, in other words, I can sit there and go, oh, well, maybe I'm wrong. Maybe I'm wrong, don't think for a second I haven't thought about this and had second thoughts about it. I'm like, gosh, am I wrong about this? And I go back and I look at the numbers and I look at other analysts and I look at other people's writings. If these people knew how much I read every week, Michael knows how much I read every week, from very high-end sources that we vetted over 40 years to find out nobody's perfect, but who I think give the best indicators and the best information, the best macroeconomic and market research. And we're, you know, one of them has 60 economists in 8 offices around the world. None of them are brokerage firms typically because the potential for bias is there because of political issues and they want the market to go up because that makes everybody in their firm happy. But the bottom line is I come back after at the end of the day, I'm like, okay, I'm looking at all this stuff. This soft landing, is it going to happen? Blah, blah, blah. I'm like, it still looks like a recession is coming to me, period. We still do not know what will shoot the cannon. We know the overvaluation is there. We know it's the second highest level of margin debt ever, which is built-in selling on the downside. And I'm looking at this other report. This is not from EPB. This is from a different firm, but they said the leading index is still falling. So it's falling, and the decline is lasting longer than normal. So if, again, you go back to your roller coaster analogy, what you're seeing here is that it seems to be taking a little bit longer for the momentum of the bottom part of the train to catch up for the rest of the train, but it's still pointing the same direction. Let me give you some stuff. EPB did EPB, by the way, if you're in business, I would subscribe to their service because it is worth its weight in gold.
Just epbresearch.com.
That's right. They went back and they documented how long, what is the lead time? And this is why Milton Friedman always said the lead time between what the Fed does and how it affects the economy is variable, and it can be long or short. It's
long and variable lags.
Long and variable lags, exactly, to quote him exactly.
I'm glad you remember that.
Long and variable lags. Let's go back over the last several recessions and see how long the lags were. Number one, 1970. In 1970, there was 7-month lag time from when the leading index of economic indicators went down until it affected the economy and we went into recession. 74 was an anomaly. It was an unusual year. In 74, guess how long the lead time was?
Well, if you said unusual, it's going to be real short.
Zero! There was literally there was zero lead time from the time that the leading index of economic indicators said we're in a recession until the recession was there. It was instantaneous. 1980 was 10 months. Now, you talk about, you're saying this is going to be this is going to be variable, lagging and variable, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's lagging. In each case, it's lagging. That's the only one that was coincident. Every other one is lagging. But variable, 7 months on the first one, 0 months on the second one. The third one was in 1980. In 1980, it was 10 months. 10 months is a pretty good bit of time. You're almost a year. In 1990, you had 17 months. 17 months when the leading index of economic indicators was saying, hey guys,
hello, wake up down there. I know you've passed out and you've gone to sleep in the storage room. Wake up. The recession is coming now, but it's not here yet. 17 months to go.
So that's what was happening. You got a long lead time of 17 months. That's unusual. That's the second longest. Guess what the first one is? I'll come back to that. In 2000, you had an 8-month lead time. 8 months from the time that the leading index of economic indicators said, hey, we're crossing over our signal, we're saying a recession's coming, and it was accurate. 2008, 14 months. That's a long time between the time when the leading index of economic indicators said it's time to get the heck out of Dodge. And again, the part of the problem is if you start acting on this, this is your early precursor. If you get out of the market when the precursor hits, you miss the whole last bull market leg, which is maybe a third of the whole bull market. So that's tough to deal with. 14 months in 2008, this time 19 months and counting. Okay, so one of two things is wrong. Either the force of gravity, in my view, does not work, or it's got an extremely long lag time. And you can see why now, because of the fiscal stimulus. Not only did they pass out the stimulus checks to everybody, which created excess savings, people are going back to work now, but they still have a little left over, but you also had the manufacturing bills. Never going back to World War II have we had a period of time when Biden's in control, the Senate is in Democratic hands, and so is Congress, and they pass enormous stimulus bills, some of which had good purposes, enormous stimulus bills, 7% of GDP, if I remember correctly, passed while you're in a recovery. Okay, so all of that means what? It means that the lag time, in my view, and again, I'm soul searching this daily as we speak, weekly as a, again, I mentioned, I don't know if I said this out loud or not, or just when we were talking about the amount of research that I read from carefully selected sources, which in my opinion are some of the world's leading analysts, macroeconomic and market. What would you say? How thick is the research weekly, in your opinion?
Oh, all I know is it's a lot. It's every day. If I'm not reading a bunch, I'm behind.
It's 2 to 3 inches thick of stuff from all these firms. Sometimes I get overloaded, and it's 6 inches of stuff that I have to go through to get to where I'm coming. But what you're getting every day, folks, when you listen to our show, Smart Money, is you're getting the distillation. So you got normal week is 2 to 3 inches of high-end research. We have carefully vetted the track records on these people to say how good are they, should we listen to them or not. That's been a 40-plus year process of vetting those people. We take analysts that are not paid by brokerage firms. There are some phenomenal analysts that are with the brokerage firms. Unfortunately, politically, it's difficult sometimes for them to say what they really want to say. I just have to be honest. But they may be better than many of the people we're taking, but we can't get access to them, and we can't trust the potential for bias there. Confirmation bias is a part of us. So we've had record stimulus in both the fiscal and the monetary. The Fed pumped enormous amounts of money in the economy, which delayed all this.
We had the Jobs and Manufacturing Act, the variety of things that they did there, and the Fed didn't take the punch bowl away for a long time. That's something we've forgotten about. That is such an old adage.
I'm not even sure what that one meant.
Well, what happens is everybody's having a party, and the Fed comes in and takes the punch bowl away. Well, here's my question. If people are inebriated and having a great time at the party and they take the punch bowl away, how quickly does the party die down? It doesn't die down right away. Why? Because they got a whole lot of juice in them at the moment from the punch bowl. But when the Fed comes in and says, I'm taking the punch bowl away, you know that the party has started to end. Over and out. When the Fed starts raising rates, and they raise rates at the second fastest rate in the history of the United States, and they finally stop, that's your signal that the punch bowl has been taken away. They're not going to put more money in the system. They are not going to stimulate the party anymore with alcohol. The punch bowl is now taken away. It's just a matter of time until everybody kind of, it all wears off. That's the analogy I want to end with. Next week, we'll talk a little bit more about what we didn't get to today, the difference in bull and bear markets, secular and cyclical, because we got some phenomenal information from Ned Davis right here that really helps. And I think it's going to help us know where we're going in the next 5 years and where we're going in the next 10. Really important information. Jerry Tuma, Michael Williams, more with Smart Money next week.
Jerry Tuma's Smart Money is a broadcast of Cornerstone Financial Services of Dallas, Texas. Jerry Tuma is a certified financial planner. Financial advisors at Cornerstone could help you if you prefer to delegate your investment decisions to a financial professional. Securities and advisory services offered through Independent Financial Group, LLC, a registered investment advisor, member FINRA SIPC. Cornerstone Financial Services and Independent Financial Group, LLC, are unaffiliated entities. We publish a newsletter, Cornerstone Report, which is available on our website or by calling our toll-free number at 800-327-4285. That's also the number to call for more information about anything we've discussed during today's broadcast. For more information, visit our website at cornerstonereport.com. Views and opinions heard on Jerry Tuma's Smart Money are not necessarily the opinion of this station or its management or Independent Financial Group, LLC, its affiliates, officers, or directors. Material on this program is intended for general information only and should not be taken as specific investment, tax, or legal advice. Remember, we are aiming to change the way America thinks about investing.